We're checking in on the health of the timber industry in our state here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin pulp and paper is big business, an $18 billion industry in pre-COVID times, employing more than 30,000 workers. That's from a state report produced last year by the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point. But the supply chain is struggling after the Verso mill went dark in Wisconsin Rapids this summer, putting about 900 people out of work. Do you work in logging or at a mill or in another aspect of the supply chain? What effects is the pandemic having on your business connected to timber? We're at 800-642-1234. Henry Schinnebeck is executive director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association based in Rhinelander. Henry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, give us a sense of how this timber industry is doing here in Wisconsin amid the pandemic.
Well, it's been kind of a bit of a roller coaster to start with. You know, the pandemic really was having an impact before the Verso mill closed, you know, and you started seeing in March, you know, as the stay-at-home orders were being issued, nobody really knew what to expect. And we saw quite a slowdown in the amount of wood that manufacturers were consuming.
Well, it was the toilet paper saga.
Well, I'm still baffled by that one. But, you know, that part of the paper industry is absolutely going great guns, producing all they can produce. And, you know, we're still seeing some shortages on the shelves and some limits as to how much you can buy and that type of thing. I'm still a little bit baffled by that one, but I think the whole industry is, you know, but then the writing industry is the one that's really taken the hit as people were staying home, magazines weren't being bought, that type of thing. And that part of the paper industry was struggling a little bit, probably for the last year and a half, maybe a little bit longer. And, you know, the building industry as well, Wisconsin has a lot of, manufacturers like Louisiana Pacific that make building products and that type of thing, and that came to a little bit of a slowdown, and there was a lot of uncertainty, but as we're seeing now, as people are staying home, they're doing a lot of projects, and building materials are actually moving pretty good.
Well, yeah, lumber is picking up. I see that, you know, that there are some strong sales there for lumber. Is that because people are building homes and doing home improvement?
Yeah, I think they're doing home improvements. You know, if you have, you know, in Rhinelander here, I have some of the local stores like the Home Depots and the Menards. They've always been kind of busy, but it's unbelievable. They had to start, you know, placing limits on how many people could be in the store and that type of thing. And I think people are just finding ways to use their time and making investments in their homes, which is good. And, you know, doing a lot of home improvement projects that maybe were being put off. You know, and you have young families now that are very involved in sports and stuff that takes a lot of time to travel and be involved in all those things. And we've seen that slow down quite a bit. And so they basically have time to do other things.
We're talking with Henry Schinnebeck, who is Executive Director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. We're discussing the state of the timber industry amid COVID and how different aspects of the supply chain are doing. With your insights, do you work at a mill? How is it going? Is your mill threatening to close or to slow down? Maybe that the mill is really picking up due to more consumer demand for products like paper towels or toilet paper. Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. I mean, Henry, before we move on, I want to talk a little bit more because we're still seeing a paper towel shortage going on. And here we are in September. What is the issue here with things like paper towels and toilet paper?
You know, to the best of my knowledge, we've got like 34 paper mills in the state of Wisconsin. And some of those are geared toward printing paper, that type of thing. And you have a lot of them that are making the personal paper products. And I think that, you know, consumers are just buying a lot more. And maybe that has to do with being home more. They're using more product that typically they were maybe using where they worked or that type of thing, or maybe because they're not working, but you know, and those mills are running wide open, doing the best they can to keep up with the demand. And one of the issues is that, you know, like the Verso mill that closed, they were doing printing paper. It takes a long time. If they wanted to convert that mill to something else, it takes a long time to convert it, and millions of dollars to put different equipment in for producing different types of paper. So I guess for now, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens with manufacturing, if they can somehow improve that or add another manufacturing facility or, you know,
let's talk about the Verso situation. So, you know, the context here is in June, Verso announces, it's a company based in Ohio, announces it's going to indefinitely idle its mills in Wisconsin Rapids and in Duluth, Minnesota. And this closure of both of these plants is more than 1,000 people in their jobs. Tell us what led to this decision. Is it all about, you know, just what the mill produces, and that is, you know, paper that goes into magazines and the like?
Yeah, that had a lot to do with it. You know, as I said earlier, they were struggling a little bit with the paper industry as far as the printing industry and that type of thing, and the product they were making. And I think when the COVID stay-at-home orders started coming in, people just weren't out. They weren't going to the stores. They weren't purchasing the magazines off the shelf. And that really, I think, kind of speeded up their decision to close the mills, you know, idle them down. It's just one of those things where they're supply and demand. The warehouses were full of paper, and, you know, you can only sustain making a product so long if there's no market for it. And I think it was just a good business decision on their part, as far as their investors and stuff go, that they had to idle that mill down and the Duluth mill as well.
Do you know anything there about the Wisconsin Rapids situation? Are they idling it and just keeping up the mill itself, or are they selling it for parts and dismantling the mill? What is the situation?
Yeah, they have the mill up for sale. There's a group called Mollis and Company. They're actually in charge of selling the mill. They don't plan to tear it down, to the best of my knowledge. And it's our understanding, working with the Wisconsin Rapids Together group and Representative Krug and Senator Teston and others, that there are some interested parties in the mill. You know, I mean, that would be the worst thing, is if it was tore down and sold for scrap, that it's very hard to bring an industry like that back. And being that they are probably the largest wood consumer in this region of raw material, that would put a real hardship on forest health in the state of Wisconsin. That mill consumes probably, so Wisconsin produces, according to the latest figures, about 2.8 million cords of wood a year. That's very, very sustainable. We're still growing two times more trees than we're harvesting at that level. And they bought about 25% of that.
That's a big chunk of the market.
That's a big chunk of the market, huge chunk of the market.
We're discussing the state of the timber industry amid the pandemic economic fallout with Henry Schinnebeck. He heads up the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. Can the forest industry survive a recession? Did your mill bounce back after the Great Recession? What state and federal resources does the timber industry need right now in Wisconsin? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the state of the timber industry here in Wisconsin amid the economic downturn brought on by the pandemic. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a state study last year, we lead the nation in the number of paper mills and the number of workers. We export pulp and paper products to dozens of countries around the world. What is the situation now, especially with the Verso mill closure in Wisconsin Rapids we've been talking about? Did you work for the Verso mill? What are you doing now? Is your mill cutting back hours or finding that it can't keep up amid the pandemic? Share what you know about the market conditions around pulp and paper at 800-642-1234. Henry Schinebeck leads the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and stays with us. So, Henry, back to Wisconsin Rapids and the Verso situation. What effect is that having on Rapids?
Well, I when I'm looking at the economic data down there, even to the counties right around there and stuff, you know, it's in over $500 million of taxes and different things that they're going to see as a loss coming up. And, you know, we've talked to some of the workers there, and, of course, a lot of them are looking for their jobs or maybe being retrained and that type of thing. So it's really really pushes us a little bit to get that mill back up and running as quickly as we possibly can. And when you look at the logger side of it, there were over 500 loggers that had a contract to supply that mill with wood. And then you start adding in the truckers. Well, that's over 2,000 log trucks that are hauling. And between that and Duluth, you know, we figured easily 3,000 loggers and truckers were impacted by the closing of those two mills. And then, of course, you start adding in and doing a multiplier. You've got equipment dealers that sell only logging equipment, provide services. You have all the fuel stops, that type of thing. You know, there's just no activity going in there right now. And we've got members that are idled, have been idled since March, and haven't done any production at all. And when the logging industry has changed quite a bit. You know, we've gone from being really labor intensive to being technology driven. A lot of the harvesting equipment has high technology in it. It's a one person operation to cut the tree down, cut it to length, sort it to the best, highest use and highest possible value. And so it's changed quite a bit, but all that equipment comes with a very high cost. You're looking at, you know, for just basically a two-man operation, probably $1.5 million investment, and these guys get paid by production. If they're not producing a cord of wood, delivering it to the mill, and in return getting paid for that, they have no income coming in. And it's specialized equipment, so you can't, it's not possible really just to convert it to maybe doing dirt work or that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, you know,
what do I do now? Yeah, the closure of one mill permeates so many aspects of the economy that we may not even think about. Let's bring in a call now. Troy is joining us from Neillsville this morning. Hi, Troy.
Morning, Kate. How are you?
Doing well. What can you provide here? What's your perspective?
Well, it's been very interesting with the closure of the Rapids paper mill. My family has been supplying pulpwood to that mill for the last 60 plus years, and I'm a third generation timber harvester, and we've had to repurpose and retool, and hopefully we can survive this shutdown.
What are you doing now, Troy, as the mill is closed?
We are just harvesting for other paper mills at the time, which do not take the volume that the Verso mill did.
How is that going for you?
Very rough, to say that. At least.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of be the last man standing, I guess you would say, you know.
How important is it for you to carry on this tradition in your family, this tradition that's gone on for generations of supplying the industry?
I just feel like it's in my blood almost, kind of like farming. And, you know, I grew up around our timber harvesting and our sawmill and all that stuff. And it's just great pride, you know, and supplying that industry like that.
Troy, thank you for bringing that family perspective. Henry, you know, Troy being a third generation timber harvester and really having to retool in these unprecedented times, what would you tell him?
Well, I know we've talked, and you know, a lot of times, as Troy mentioned, this is for a lot of people, a lot of our members, actually, I'm a third generation logger myself, and our son, our oldest son, started logging here probably about 2 or 3 years ago after being in Alaska for a few years. And it is part of your blood. It's your tradition. It's your way of life. And a lot of times I don't think the public really understands what forest management does and what sustainable forest management does in the state of Wisconsin. You know, we've got some of the best forest in the United States in Wisconsin. We don't have the fires that they have out west because a lot of it's been sustainably managed. And the last thing you want to do as a logger is run out of trees, right? Mm. And that's why we're so passionate about making sure that our forest health is maintained. And we can only do that through guys like Troy that are doing the work to do the management. You know, the forest will eventually take care of itself, but we can really sustain that much better by doing that forest management. You know, and for guys like Troy, all we can tell them right now is hopefully they can retool, like he said, and you know, work at something else for a while. You have to do what you have to do to survive. And I've been in that position myself where I've had to go out and do other work. And I know a lot of guys have repurposed and they really need to stay in touch with their financial institution. You know, the people that are financing all this high-tech equipment, they need to know what's going on. And communicating with them is a key part to surviving through this because, you know, you might have to extend your loan. You might have to do different things and make interest-only payments for a while. And hopefully in the meantime, somebody's looking at that mill to maybe purchase it. Other groups are looking at it to maybe purchase it. We're looking for new opportunities. You know, there's a lot of discussion about cross-laminated timber and why aren't we utilizing some of our forest products that we're growing here for that type of product. So there's a lot of things in the works, but they all take time to develop. And, you know, when that mill, guys were already suffering a little bit from COVID, from the pandemic, and then when the mill shut down, that just really added to that, you know, to the stress that's being placed on these guys.
To the stress of the industry. I want to reintroduce you. Henry Schinebeck heads up the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. It's based in Rhinelander, and we're checking in on the health of the timber industry as the Versal mill shut down over the summer. Let's go to Carol now, joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning. My father was employed at the original Kimberly Clark mill when they shut down. And I think that the mills are one of the last kind of employers that really people make a long-term commitment to. They don't go to their work for 2 years and go look for a different job. These are jobs that people make their commitment to. And when Kimberly Clark shut down, my father had been there for almost 25 years, but not old enough to retire. So his skill level, the world had changed in the 25 years that he had made his commitment to Kimberly Clark Mill. And so when they shut down and he had to go find a different job, he had a skill set that was not adapted to a different world. And that was very, very hard on our family.
Carol, thank you for calling. Henry, finding that transferable skill set in this industry, very difficult. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Carol. It is, and just like Troy said, it's part of your blood. It's in your veins, and it's just a tradition that you've carried on for most of my life. I mean, my grandfather was a logger. My dad logged. My grandfather ran logging camps way back, and
do you know?
It gets in your blood, and I sit in the office now. I've been at this position for about 12 or 13 years, and I still get the urge to go out. In fact, I do go out sometimes on our son's operation and cut some wood because it's just part of who you are. It's part of your DNA.
Do you know how the state is helping retrain workers who have been laid off from Verso and other mills?
I do not. Haven't really been engaged in that part of it for the mill workers themselves and what they're doing. You know, we primarily as an organization, we represent loggers and truckers and landowners.
Sure.
And actually Versal was a member of the mill because we work on a lot of forestry related issues. But I just don't know the answer to that and how they're...
Very quickly, I know you formed a co-op. In the last few seconds we have, what is the goal of forming a co-op?
Well, we're looking at the multi-stakeholder co-op model as potentially having ownership of that mill or perhaps some other type of wood-consuming mill. It's a little bit of a control-your-own-destiny type of thing, you know, and we're looking at long-term commitment. If you look at our forest products industry over the last 15, 20 years, the Mead families that own Consolidated Paper, that's not the normal business model anymore. It's, you know, companies come in, or investment groups, whatever, come in and they buy a mill like Verso. They run it 5 to 7 years. That's the average life. And they turn around and they sell it. We're trying to figure out a way through the cooperative. Can we make a long-term commitment here that that mill is going to be in place for 30, 40, 50 years and be much more sustainable with our loggers and in our timber industry and sustainable forest health?
Henry, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity.
Henry Schinnebeck is Executive Director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. Coming up, we talk with our rural communities reporter, Rob Menser. That's after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on campaigning in the swing state of Wisconsin amid the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump narrowly won Wisconsin in 2016 by fewer than 23,000 votes. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett told the Showtime political documentary series The Circus recently,
"I don't think anybody should be cocky about the state of Wisconsin at all. I think it's a battleground, and it's going to remain a battleground till 8 o'clock on November 3rd.
Have you been to a gathering to support your candidate since the pandemic started? Where was the event? Did you wear a mask? How large was the gathering? Join in at 800-642-1234. Rob Menser is Wisconsin Public Radio's Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with yesterday's visit by Vice President Mike Pence. Visited Janesville on the campaign trail. What can you tell us about what the atmosphere was like?
So the vice president's event was an indoor event, which has been rare in this political season, given pandemic constraints. But this one was indoors. They do have protocols. They do a temperature check. They give out masks at the event. Of course, many people don't wear the masks at the event, and it looked from photographs. You know, I wasn't at the event, but photographs appeared that social distancing was not really a thing there. So the temperature checks are one thing, but of course there, you know, it doesn't capture asymptomatic folks. So it's a concern when there's a whole bunch of people brought together in an indoor event, but that's seems like that's what we're seeing more of.
And President Trump is expected to return to the state Thursday. Mosinee is a stop. He recently visited Kenosha in the wake of the Jacob Blake shooting. What did these in-person visits consist of, and what do we expect Thursday?
Sure. Well, President Trump's visit to Kenosha was really tied to the events there, the property destruction and problems in the wake of the shooting by police of Jacob Blake there. So Trump's visit to Kenosha specifically was about highlighting the toll that those protests and riots took in that city. That was a theme of the Republican National Convention. And so when he came to Janesville, he was hitting some of those same notes. But it is important to say, you know, the president has visited Wisconsin already multiple times this year. The visit to Mosinee coming up on Thursday here in central Wisconsin is going to be, you know, he's been in Oshkosh. He was in Marinette Marine to speak about some military contracts, and those events are quite different in tone. The Mosinee event is a rally. You know, that's an outdoor event.
Is it at the airport? I understand.
Yeah, it's right at the airport. So he'll fly into the airport, but it's at a it's the central Wisconsin airport. So it's at a sort of a place where people from all over sort of central Wisconsin, I expect northern, western, rural Wisconsin will be able to travel to this. And it's a campaign rally. So he's going to give a big speech in front of a big crowd that'll be outdoors. But that's sort of a different sort of thing.
What are you seeing out of the Biden camp as it pertains to campaigning, and especially here in Wisconsin?
So this was one of the real things I found as I was reporting out a story on campaigning in COVID times, is just a strong difference between the approaches of Democratic campaigns and Republican campaigns in general. It's just the case that the Democrats up and down the ballot are taking a more cautious approach toward in-person campaigning. And certainly the presidential candidate, Joe Biden, is an example of that. He has, since the beginning of September, has done some in-person events. He also visited Kenosha in the wake of unrest there. But his events, they're just very different. He'll give a speech without an audience. Or there in Kenosha, he wore a mask throughout his speech and spoke in a church. It was an indoor event, but with quite strict social distancing requirements, with only a couple dozen people in this large space, and everyone required to wear a mask.
So very different approaches to the campaign trail, even though Biden is out on the campaign trail today in Florida. The one stop in Wisconsin so far, is that, give us any insight there? Because the Democrats were criticized in 2016. Hillary Clinton criticized for not showing up in Wisconsin. Is that a drawback for Biden here?
Sure. I think so. This is sort of like the central conflict, right? There's a couple things going on, right? There is the actual risk of the pandemic, the objective risk that a large event could cause the disease to spread and cause people to get COVID-19. There's also a perception risk, which is there are some number of voters, I don't know the number, but it's not zero, who are turned off by the perception that politicians are behaving in a way that is risky or is not considerate of the health of their supporters. And then there is, on the other side of the ledger, there is the reality that politicians campaign because voters like it. People like to see and hear from their political leaders directly, and campaign events get votes. It's the way it's always been for forever. And I don't think there's a reason to think that is like somehow goes away in the COVID era. There's some evidence to suggest, at least from sources that I spoke to, that after a candidate's visit, after the president appeared in the Marinette area, that that Republicans had greater success in their canvassing efforts, phone calling efforts after that, because it has the same effect it's always had. A candidate visit gets people excited about the candidate.
How do local officials, local office holders feel about these candidate visits, these in-person visits?
Yeah, so, you know, in Kenosha, Democratic leaders asked the president not to visit Kenosha, including Governor Tony Evers. Evers later said that he would prefer that Biden not visit either, but it was pretty clear he didn't make the same issue of that. I think that more commonly local political leaders like to have national figures visit them. You know what I mean? I think that there absolutely are concerns that people have, but I have seen a lot of photos of local leaders want to meet with the politicians who are visiting in their area, and if it's an in-person event, they're going to do it in person.
We're talking with Rob Mentzer, who is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. We're discussing the campaign trail 7 weeks ahead of Election Day. Are you someone who typically goes out to support local candidates and convince Wisconsinites to vote? Do you feel safe to do so during the pandemic? Have you attended one of these gatherings to support your candidate since the pandemic? Where was the event? Did you wear a mask? Were there a lot of people gathered? Join in with your insights at 800-642-1234. Rob, let's turn to local campaign efforts. In early August, the Wisconsin Democratic Party held an online training session for candidates. What information was provided at the meeting?
So this was part of my reporting, and the in short, the Democratic Party said at that time, it's not safe to go door to door. They also said at the same meeting that each candidate will decide what is right for them in their community. And so I spoke with some candidates who sort of felt like there's like a, that created a gray area. There is a, there's a area where they can thread the needle. And there are some Democratic candidates who for local offices, assembly races typically are quite reliant on door-to-door canvassing. And there are some Democratic candidates who are doing door-to-door canvassing for these down-ticket races, and they do it in by wearing masks and sort of knocking on the door and backing up. Honestly, I've talked to people in both parties who are following this this protocol. They sort of back way up after they knock on the door, and somebody answers. They say like, "Is it okay? Can I talk to you?" And sort of try to gauge people's comfort level. And that seems to be sort of where we are. And again, like if you're standing outdoors on somebody's porch and you're 6 feet back, I don't think that's considered a high risk activity. But it's just that it is a consideration that candidates have to face is, do I have my volunteers do this? Do I feel comfortable with that? Do they feel comfortable with that? And is there a risk that people are just not going to like it? They're not going to feel comfortable having somebody, some stranger, knock on their door in the middle of a pandemic.
And you talked with Appleton Democrat Lee Snodgrass and her campaign efforts for the 57th Assembly District. She's running against Eric Beach. What is her approach to campaigning?
So she is one who is choosing to do door-to-door contacts, or has been, did in August for sure. And she follows that protocol, right? And she even said, she wears her mask 100% of the time as she's going door to door for the reason that she doesn't know when somebody's going to like snap a photo or see her, you know what I mean? Not complying, even if she's outdoors like by herself. And so she, no matter how hot it got over the summer, she was wearing it all the time. She did not have any volunteers going door to door. She was doing it herself. And so that also meant that she dramatically reduced the number and tried to really target the areas, neighborhoods where she was actually going door to door. She wasn't going to places where the expectation was that a lot of Democrats were going to vote. It was, you know, she really focused in on the swingy areas. And I think that's something that a lot of candidates are doing.
We're talking about the campaign running through Wisconsin, what that means 7 weeks before Election Day. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter. What are your thoughts on in-person campaigning? Do you think it's safe, or should candidates try different tactics? What do you suggest? How do you feel about presidential candidates visiting our state during the COVID crisis and in the wake of the protests of police brutality? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rob Mentzer here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with WPR's rural communities reporter, Rob Mentzer. He's been reporting on how Wisconsin candidates are handling in-person campaigning during the pandemic. Meanwhile, both Vice President Mike Pence and President Trump have been courting voters in our swing state. Pence campaigned in Janesville yesterday. President Trump will return to Mosinee Thursday. Let's take a call now. Cole is joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Cole.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My comment is in regards to the presidential election, the race, and I think that most Democrats are probably okay with Biden not doing a ton of, you know, rallies and stuff like that in Wisconsin, despite the disappointment from 2016. But I think one thing that their campaign could do better is have more virtual rallies or meetings targeted at Wisconsin residents, or even, you know, small gatherings that are broadcast on local national television, more structured social distancing events with, you know, say teachers here in Wisconsin or things like that. I think that's an opportunity that they really should at least try to capture compared to what they did in 2016.
Cole, thanks for the insights. Rob, what have you seen of more structured social distancing efforts by the campaigns?
Sure. Well, I think that Cole makes a point that the whole element of campaigning in 2020 in a pandemic is there are just dozens of virtual campaign events going on all over the state. They may not necessarily, as he points out, Joe Biden may not be appearing at those, but I've attended a number of virtual events for all sorts of campaigns where they'll bring together, brewery owners who want to speak about the effect on their business of the pandemic, or Republican campaigns as well will focus on dairy farmers or whatever. The problem is, so those campaigns exist. The problem is they just don't get the same level of attention. They don't get people's attention in the same way. That includes the media, but I think it also includes everyday voters. There has been some creativity in the virtual campaigning space. Just on this week, the Wisconsin Democratic Party held that virtual sort of table read of the Princess Bride with the Princess Bride cast. And honestly, like, there was like more than 100,000 people were streaming that at a time. it made them a bunch of money and it got people's attention, right? People like love that movie. So, it's not that these things can't work. But I do think that there's like a bit of a higher bar to clear for a virtual event to just like get attention. And so, Joe Biden back in the primary, like, he started a podcast, but like no one really listened to it. You know what I mean? So it's a challenge in a way that everyone covers live campaign events. It's just like what the media does. And it's harder. There's an adjustment when it comes to a virtual event.
Cole also mentioned that Democrats are okay with Biden taking more of a muted approach to rallies, not bringing people together. Are there any insights there? Is there any polling data there?
Polling data is quite consistent that that Democrats are more supportive of restrictions around the pandemic and in general more cautious. So I think that it's probably right that that Democrats are not likely to hold the vice president's relatively few appearances against him. Of course, the problem is it's not just Democrats. The campaigns need to appeal to swing voters and independent voters and voters on the other side. And so there is this, there is this public opinion gap. And I think you see that reflected in the way the campaigns are conducting themselves. What's a little less clear to me is whether one approach or the other will attract more people in the middle.
WPR's Rob Mentzer is with us. He's the rural communities reporter. We're discussing what the campaign trail looks like amid the pandemic, and we're 7 weeks ahead of Election Day, taking your insights on it as well at 800-642-1234. Rob, I wonder if you're having whiplash here, because 7 weeks out, journalists would be running all over the place to campaign events, trying to keep up with candidates. And so what is it like? What's changed for you as a journalist in covering campaigns?
It's like I've definitely had days where it's like from one Zoom meeting to the next whiplash, but it's not quite the same. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm like everyone else, right? Like, so I have a child at home. Wausau schools are doing virtual schools right now. So like I would not be able to go and cover a bunch of in-person campaign events this season anyway, or it would be a challenge. So it's a, I think that, I still feel like we will see more of the candidates in Wisconsin in the next 7 weeks. I do expect that Joe Biden specifically will do some form of larger scale events it's in Wisconsin. I just think the state is too important. But I assume it will look different. It'll be at an amphitheater. You know what I mean? It probably won't look like the Trump events.
We have a couple callers who want to talk about third party candidates, and they were on scratchy lines, but I want to make sure that their questions get asked. You know, campaigns are trying to reach third party candidates as well. So, you know, maybe what is the campaigning that you've seen if there are third party candidates on the ballot? What is their approach?
Sure. Well, it looks like there may not be, although they can run a write-in campaign or try to build support in other ways. And I think that you know, it's always hard for a third-party candidate to get attention from a large number of voters. It's just sort of the way it goes. But I do think that. You know, one of the things that we're seeing is like there has been some creativity in campaigning in general. It's like the, you know, Trump supporters boat parades have gotten a certain amount of attention. But like a boat parade is a totally, you know, socially distant, safe, COVID safe activity. And it's a way that they've been able to get attention for their candidate. You know, on the Democratic side, the candidate Lee Snodgrass that I wrote about, she hosted a walking tour of downtown Appleton to talk about pollinators, to talk about bees and keeping like a bee garden. And it was this outdoor event. It was socially distanced. It was mask required. And so it was COVID safe. It was fine.
Well, let's take a call. Marsha in Kakana. Hi, Marsha.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. I recently traveled just last week from Kakana to La Crosse down to Prairie du Chien, back up through Madison to Kakana. And I know I didn't count more than 24 Biden signs compared to probably 300 or 400 Trump signs, banners, flags, you name it. And I just don't see that. And I think, you know, in this time of COVID and lockdown, we need more signage. People do go out to grocery stores and essential places. And, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, Marcia, thanks for bringing those observations. Rob, you know, Marcia has done some windshield time driving around and counting signs and has some insights there, is not seeing the Biden signs.
No, I think that's right. You know, if you'll recall, in 2016, the Trump campaign made a lot of their the number of yard signs, and the smart people in the political class said that's ridiculous. That's not a measure of anything. Crowd size doesn't tell you how people are going to ultimately vote. And of course, it did actually tell us something about enthusiasm for the Trump campaign. And I you know, a yard sign doesn't vote. But there's no question that the Trump campaign is winning the yard sign war in Wisconsin. There's just no question about it. She's right.
Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Mentzer is WPR's Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau. Just ahead, we talk with a first responder, a former police officer, and the head of the Center for Suicide Awareness about what can be done to help first responders process the traumas they encounter through their line of work. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.